Leah Wang. Derek, could I ask you, first of all, to tell me something about your family background? Perhaps starting with your parents.
My parents were born and brought up in Plumstead in South London. It was in those days, of course, my father was born 1903, my mother 1904. It was virtually a plum village. It was a fruit growing area, of course, in Kent. They met and married there in 1932, and I was born the year after, 1933. Their parents were, in my mother's case, born and brought up in Plumstead. Her father was a professional soldier for the Buffs. Yes. And he was a professional soldier from the age of 16 to the age of, I think I'm correct in saying, 32. So it's quite a long time, about 16 years. He was out in Afghanistan, the Northwest Frontier, 5 years, and told me some hair-raising stories about that. Particularly the one about when they used to go into forays in Afghanistan, actually across the border, yeah, through the Khyber Pass, and into Afghanistan. Every trooper used to be issued with 101 rounds, 100 for the Afghans, and one for you, lad. Just in case the Afghans catch you. don't let them capture you. And then he was in the Boer War in South Africa and in East Africa. And then he left the army and became a businessman. His wife was a dressmaker, and she ran her own business for most of their married life. On my father's side, his mother was the daughter of German immigrants into Britain. They came here in 1870. My great-grandfather discovered that he was due to be called up to fight in the Franco-Prussian War, which was generated by Bismarck, of course, and he decided they didn't want to fight the French because he said he had no quarrel with them. So they came here. Now, he was a master baker, and he set up shop immediately. He got here with borrowed money, and my grandmother was born, I think, shortly after they came. They had three children, as far as I remember, or I think all girls, or two other girls. My grandmother's husband was born in Devonshire, came to London looking for work, and they met in Plumstead and got married, and they had eight children, one died at childbirth, four boys and three girls. My father was the third, I think. Very bright man. He was an excellent mathematician, very good athlete and gymnast, exceptionally good. In fact, a good all-rounder, really, or virtually everything he did. he was a man to set an example to a boy. Great integrity. If he said he would do something, he did it. Very much to be relied upon. And in later years, when we were abroad, I think that's what got us through, really. He went to Regent Street Polytechnic in the 1920s and to study civil engineering, and subsequently was employed by a firm in London. He worked on jobs like the Mersey Tunnel and the design of the sports stadium at Wembley, which he would probably be rather sad to see being demolished. And then he was working with a firm in London called the Trust Concrete Company. That's T-R-U-S-S-E-D. And he told me that this was 1935, so I was two. And he told me that he was sitting in the drawing office. He was still in a fairly junior position at that stage. And the number of places in the drawing office were no longer occupied, gradually increasing. And he realised it was going to be his turn at some stage or other. But there just wasn't any work. And so he saw an advertisement in the Daily Telegraph for an engineer in Singapore. The employer was the Air Ministry. And he applied for the job and got that. And we went out there in 1936.
So you would have been three at the time?
Just over three. And yes. By that time, I had my first sister, eldest sister, was born. She was born towards the end of 1935.
So did you have any memory at all of that life, you know, the first 2 years?
Not very much, no. We lived in a place called Oldfield Road in Bexley Heath, which was a rented house, I believe. My parents were like, I think, a lot of young people in those days. They had, both of them had been fortunate insofar as their parents were, the fathers were always employed. Both my mother's father was a private businessman. He set up shop in Plumstead after he left the army. And my father's father was the same. They were never out of work. And so they weren't poor in the sense that some people were, especially in that era. But I think they were like a lot of people of their age at that time in the country's history. They wanted to get out of the rather crowded suburbs of London into the fresher, more, what shall I say, less urban areas like Bexley Heath, which was actually not very well developed in those days, and much more in the country, as it were. And although they didn't have cars, of course, but I think it probably didn't matter. They just simply wanted to get out into the fresh air, you know. And so they rented this house in Bexley Heath, and that's where we were living when the decision was made to go abroad. I can't take you back much beyond the period of my German grandparents. I don't know who those people were. I have the bones of a research paper on it, but not enough to tell you anything important.
But you remember so very little about those 3 years in England, do you?
I can remember, for example, you know, the sort of thing that children remember, like being taken to the barber's by my father for a haircut. And I can remember my sister being brought home from the hospital by my mother. Small things of that sort, really, but nothing important. And I can remember my grandmother, because she, my mother's mother, that is, because she lived with us at the time. She was suffering from a chronic medical condition, which meant that she needed a certain amount of regular attendance. So she came to live with us in Bexley Heath. My grandfather, her husband, had the business to run in Woolwich and Plumstead. So he continued to live in Plumstead and came on the weekend to Bexley Heath. And that continued right up to the time we went to Singapore.
Do you remember the journey?
The journey, I can remember the name of the ship. It was the SS Naldira. It was a sort of fairly standard passenger ship of those days. And I can remember, again, small things like, for example, playing a rather strange game on the deck, which was organised for the children, where each child had to stand. We stood in rows, and each child had 10 potatoes placed in front of it, you see. And the idea was that you had to run forward, pick up a potato and put it in a bucket, and then run forward and pick up the next potato. I picked them all up at the same time.
You showed great promise.
I was ticked off, however, for not doing it properly. Yes. That's one thing I do remember. And another thing I remember was when we stopped in Colombo, in what was then Ceylon, to re-coal. And an enormous coaling ship came alongside, fairly close, and they put a gangway, kind of bridge, between two ships. And then these Tamil coolies, who were very black in any case, because Tamils do tend to be very dark, were hauling the. It was like a series of little trolleys on rails, which were filled with coal, and then they ran down and tipped the coal into the bunker in the ship, and then they turned around and ran up the other. But they were pushed by these. There was nothing automatic. They were pushed by these coolies, and I can remember standing there with my father, watching this quite close to the scene of action, and this very dark, to me, very large black man, smiling, and what I remember is the brilliance of his teeth. It's the sort of thing a child would notice, and that was the one thing that was white, you know. Everything, of course, he was covered in coal dust as well, which made him even blacker. You know? And I do remember that quite distinctly. And I remember the occasion when my mother inadvisedly put a table under the porthole. And of course, in those days, there was an outer door and an outer window and an inner window, and one, so there was a kind of double lock on the thing. And it was very hot as we got down towards India, and she opened the porthole, and I was caught hanging out. I wanted to see what was outside. She told me afterwards, she came into the cabin, all she could see was my bottom and my legs. Yes. Another few minutes, I think, that would have been it. So she hauled me back and shut the porthole and took the table away. And that I do. I actually do remember hanging out of the porthole, thinking how wonderful it was. There's all this water going past. And I was only three and a bit, really. It's astonishing when I think about it now. And I was terribly very adventurous as a boy. I get into all kinds of scrapes. And it started at that sort of age, you know. And then I do remember the arrival in Singapore itself. We disembarked in the morning of our arrival. And we were met by the man who was to become my father's senior, his boss, I suppose one might say, in the office where he was going to be working. And I can remember, I have a quite sharp memory of sitting in the front seat of the car with the Malay driver. Of course, I'd never seen coloured people before. So I was quite intrigued by this dark man who drove. With my two parents and this other gentleman sitting at the back and kneeling on the front seat, looking back at them sitting at the back. And as we drove out of the docks, being conscious of the intense heat. And I know that is a very firm memory in my mind. And we went to their house and stayed with the couple there until my father could arrange somewhere to live. And I was introduced to my first amma, a lovely Chinese. Looking back at her, she was a young girl. I don't suppose she was probably any more than about 20. And she was actually very, very beautiful. And they said to me, this is how people, you know, people in those days dealt with children as if they were mini adults. And I was told that this lady was going to look after me. And her name was, I can't remember what it was exactly, but Amas were always called Ah Heng or Ah Tai or something. It was always this R in front of it. And I'm not quite sure what it, even today, I'm not quite sure what that meant. And I was told that she was going to look after me from now on, you see. And I was in the clothes that I'd been wearing on the ship, so she was given some other clothes, fresh clothes. And I was taken by her into the bedroom where I was going to be sleeping, and she attempted to strip me off, of course, and I wasn't having it. I was terrified, and what terrified me more than anything was the fact that her features were so different from everything I had known up to that point. I mean, very Chinese, almond eyes. Beautiful, now looking back on her, but to a child of three, really quite frightening. And there was a fight. And eventually my mother came and said, look, you know, you've got to do this. Because this is, whatever her name was, can't remember it now. She was going to be looking after me anyway, you know. I was going to have it every day, so I'd better get used to it. That was the attitude. And of course I did. Children are very adaptable. But she did frighten me at first. Quite distinctly remember that. And then we moved into a flat that my father rented after a few days. And we were there for quite a long time until they managed to find a house.
And I suppose all this while you were getting used to a very different sort of life.
Completely different, yes. Oh, totally different from Bexley Heath, yes, indeed.
A culture shock.
Yes, very much so, even at that age. Some things were peculiarly the same. For example, we still had a European doctor, just like the doctor we had in Bexley Heath. So to that extent, things didn't change. And we dealt with mainly Europeans, of course, other Europeans who were there. But I think the hardest thing was getting used to the Chinese, Indian and Malay people. Once my parents acquired a house, then they very rapidly acquired a large staff of local people. My sister, of course, was only months old, I think. So, of course, she didn't have the kind of adjustment problem that I had, I think. And my mother continued to look after her in the way she had before, certainly for a while. But, of course, all children there were looked after by Amas. Mostly Chinese, although some people preferred Indian Ayers for whatever reason.
Would there have been many Europeans in Singapore at that time?
Yes.
I imagine this is the period now from your age of three, what is it, until nine?
Nine.
Until nine. That's quite a period,
yes.
Isn't it? Six years.
Yes.
Yes. So, and did you find the different nationalities, they more or less kept to different areas, or were they more mixed up in Singapore?
In those days, the population of Singapore, and I have had the opportunity of talking to an architect friend of mine who is Chinese. Within the last 2 years, I went there 2 years ago, and we discussed it at great length, of course, because he was a boy there at the same time as I was, although I didn't know him. I met him at the University College of London, where I was studying architecture. He told me that the population of Singapore round about that period, 1935, was 900,000. I gather it's now 3.7 million. I don't know exactly what the proportions were of the different ethnic groups, but certainly the Chinese were by far and away the most predominant. It was effectively a Chinese city even in those days. So I would say that, I'm making a guesstimate, I suppose, up to a point, probably half the population was Chinese, and the remainder consisted of Indian people and Malays, who were probably even then, I think, the smaller proportion of the local population. And then there was an expatriate population. I don't know how many, but I would think certainly in the region of about 150,000, perhaps, in that sort of region. Quite a big white population. And of varying nationalities as well, predominantly British, but my parents had friends who were French, for example. And we knew people who were Scandinavian. They were probably from the embassies. But there were some professional people there working as my father was, engineers, architects, others.
So your playmates, you know, as you were growing up through these years, These would mainly have been the expat community, would they?
Mainly, and there were some German people there who were friends of my parents as well. Two families. Yes, they were predominantly European and mainly English, but not always. My armour, like many of the young women who worked in European households there, lived in what was broadly known as the Chinese Quarter, and to answer your question, yes, they did, broadly speaking, live in their own quarters of Singapore, so that there was a predominantly Chinese area, there was a predominantly Indian area, but there was quite a lot of admix going on. Europeans tended to live all over the island, although not cheek by jowl with the locals, but generally speaking, they lived in our friends, my parents' friends, lived in a whole variety of different places on the island itself. And they did tend, in the main, to do what British people did, I think, in most British colonies and parts of the British Empire. They tended to keep to themselves. It was an interesting thing. My father took me to a place on the east coast of Malaya, the Malay Peninsula. We used to go over there quite frequently, just simply to get a break from the island. And on one occasion, he took me on my own, and we went to a Malay village on the east coast, which had been a Portuguese settlement, I suppose, maybe, what, two or three centuries before. And I noticed that all the children there were Malay, but they had very light skin. So I asked him why. And he's told me that there was... in fact, we actually saw a very crumbled Portuguese fort. And he said, well, you know, there were Portuguese people who are from another part of Europe here before we came. And these people are their descendants, you see.
What an interesting glimpse of empires you're getting.
Yes, that's
right. You know, this was coming really, as we now know it, to the close.
Yes.
But you were getting this very privileged view, really.
Yes, that is right. It was a place where, to a perceptive child, a child who was aware of its surroundings, there would be many opportunities to see differences which would not be apparent to somebody living here at all.
Derek Bartlett, End of Reel 1.